As some of you may know, the apparently true story about some young lads who hopped on a bus in America in the 1930s and for some reason started to try and pick a fight with the man sitting up the back of the bus by himself minding his own business. They insulted him lightly at first and he didn't respond. So they turned up the heat of the insults and still the stranger said nothing. Eventually they got to the stranger's bus stop and he stood up and they realised that he was a lot bigger than they had estimated from his seating position, and he reached into his pocket, looked down at the lads and gave them his business card before quietly walking off the bus and on his way. The lads huddled around the business card and read the words, "Joe Lewis, boxer." Now, I don't know if you know your boxing history, but this character up on the screen became the heavyweight boxing champion of the world from 1937 to 1949. They had just tried to pick a fight with a very serious man. Their assumptions about him were all wrong. The business card, not to mention the events of the next decade, would prove just how wrong they were. Now, this reportedly true story illustrates for me a common mistake people make in approaching the subject of Jesus, either through misinformation or wishful thinking or prejudice or sometimes a combination of all three. The Jesus of our imagination is sometimes very different from the Jesus of the earliest historical sources. Our assumptions about the man prove misleading. Now, I'm including here the assumptions of the Christian church, which may sound a funny thing to say in this particular building. I am frequently struck by the difference between the Jesus I hear preached in contemporary sermons and the Jesus who emerges from the pages of history. In fact, I'll be honest with you and say that deep down somewhere in my computer's hard drive are a whole stack of my own sermons about Jesus that I could no longer preach with the same sincerity. Equally questionable are some of the portraits of Jesus in popular media. Of course, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code offers the obvious soft target here. Here, the ecclesiastically conspired Son of God is stripped bare to reveal the true Jesus, who was a simple teacher who settled down with Mary Magdalene and had kids and whose descendants can now be found happily living in modern France. Some of the academic images of Jesus are equally open to question. One of the things that is often unknown is that typically the only studies to be brought to the public's attention about Jesus are the sensational ones, the ones that claim to overturn traditional understandings of Jesus. I mean, the headline, "Jesus Overturned First Century Dining Laws," is hardly going to excite a newspaper editor, right? Even though it's based on the most solid historical data. Having said that, the headline, "Jesus Was Gay," as the Brisbane's Courier-Mail printed the year before, is going to cause a small media storm, isn't it? Even though it's based, as it turns out, on the musings of an astrologer, theology student, who happens to be a gay activist. Well, over the coming weeks, I want us to look afresh at the earliest sources, the business card of Jesus, I could say, and see for ourselves what the man said and did. I want us to see not some assumed Jesus, not the Jesus of Hollywood or of my childhood or of my imaginary preference or even of my church tradition, but the Jesus as described by those closest to the events. We begin then today with the obvious first question. How do we know what we know about Jesus? What are the ancient sources of information about the man? Well, by a sheer and happy accident of history, Jesus managed to rate a mention in numerous non-Christian writings from antiquity. This is not as predictable, I should say, as you might imagine. Today we think of Jesus as the founder of the world's largest religion. But you need to cast your mind back to the first century. He was hardly known outside the tiny strip of Roman-ruled land called Palestine. He was an insignificant figure in this period. Historians are frankly amazed he rates a mention at all outside the texts of the New Testament. But in fact, we have 11 non-Christian references to Jesus, and I'm at point A, in case you're wondering where we are already. Greco-Roman references to Jesus. Jesus is mentioned in passing on 7 occasions in the writings of Greeks and Romans in the period following his death. I'm just going to quickly race through them, and I hope this doesn't bring back bad memories of HSC, ancient history, but bear with me. Firstly, around AD 55, the Greek historian Thallus mentions the darkness that coincided with the crucifixion of the one called Jesus. He quickly dismisses its significance, however, calling it simply a natural eclipse. Nothing spooky, nothing supernatural. Secondly, the Stoic writer Mara bar Serapion. You know Mara. He lived around AD 70, and he, in a letter from prison to his son, describes Jesus as a king and a teacher and a martyr, and compares him to the great Greek martyrs, Pythagoras and Socrates. Thirdly, one of my favourite references, the Roman historian Tacitus, who scathingly refers to Jesus and his execution under Pontius Pilate and describes the Christian movement as that deadly superstition. Fourthly, the Roman administrator Pliny the Younger, not to be confused with Pliny the Elder, who was his uncle, of course. Pliny the Younger wrote to the emperor and mentions the Christians in passing and mentions the Christian practice of singing hymns to Jesus as to a god. Fifthly, the Roman historian Suetonius refers to mass disturbances amongst Roman Jews over the claim that Jesus was the Christ, the Jewish Messiah. Sixthly, the Greek satirist Lucian of Samosata ridicules Jesus as that crucified sophist. And seventhly, the Greek intellectual Celsus insists that Jesus' conception was suspect and his miracles mere Egyptian magic. Nothing special there. Well, they are the Greek and Roman references. Jesus is mentioned 4 more times in Jewish writings from the 1st and 2nd centuries. Let me race through them. The 1st century Jewish historian Josephus refers to Jesus' fame as a teacher and healer and martyr, and adds that it is reported he rose again from the dead. In another text, the same writer, Josephus, recounts the martyrdom of a man named James, whom he describes as the brother of Jesus, the so-called Messiah. Thirdly, the Talmud, an ancient exposition of Jewish law, justifies Jesus' execution on the grounds that he led Israel astray and practiced sorcery, a reference to his miracles. Fourthly, in a later text, the Talmud insists that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was an adulteress, therefore Jesus a bastard. Well, these 11 Greco-Roman and Jewish references to Jesus provide little more than an outline. And I don't want to hang too much on these references, because as you can see for yourself, there's just this little handful of details. Nevertheless, it's worth me listing the handful of details we can gain from these sources about Jesus. Let me just run through them. Firstly, the name Jesus is clear from these sources. The place and time frame of his public ministry. The name of his mother. The ambiguous nature of his birth, the name of one of his brothers, his fame as a teacher, his fame as a miracle worker or sorcerer, the attribution to him of the title Messiah, his kingly status in the eyes of some, the time and manner of his execution, the involvement of both the Roman and Jewish leadership in his death, the coincidence of an eclipse at the time of his crucifixion, the report of his appearances after death, and the flourishing of a movement which worshipped him subsequently. All that before we even open the New Testament. As I just said, though, this is just an outline of his life. For the details of his life, you can't rely on this stuff. You have to turn to the third and most important source of information about the historical Jesus. I'm talking about the writings of the New Testament. I'm at point D, in case you're wondering. Recently, I was talking to a very intelligent woman, and she asked me for the sources of our information about Jesus. So I dutifully started to list the Greco-Roman ones and the Jewish ones that I just gave to you, and then I started to list the Christian sources of our knowledge of Jesus. And she stopped me and said, "But surely you can't use those. They were all written by religious believers." She somehow got it into her head that religious devotion disqualified these texts from being regarded as historical sources also. Well, let me then clear up two major misunderstandings about the New Testament. Firstly, the so-called religious nature of these writings in no way diminishes their value as historical sources. I want to say that categorically. The religious nature of these writings in no way diminishes their value as historical sources. It's true that historians take the Christian agenda into account when studying the New Testament, just as they take the imperial bias into account when studying Tacitus and the Jewish bias into account when studying Josephus. But it is simply not the case that historians pick up the New Testament and plonk it in another little basket all on its own called religious writings. Not at all. Professional scholars approach the New Testament as they would any other first century text. They don't treat it as the Word of God, as a Christian does, but they do accord it the status of a valuable historical text. In fact, it is no exaggeration at all to say that the New Testament writings are universally regarded by historians as the earliest, most plentiful, and most reliable ancient sources of information about the Jesus of history. The second thing to say is that the New Testament is not a single source at all. It's not as if we have these 11 non-Christian references to Jesus and just one called the New Testament. I need to say, from the historian's point of view, the New Testament is a collection of sources. Christians in this building need to remember that although the texts of the New Testament exist as a single volume today, originally they were composed and circulated independently of each other. In the first century, there was no such book as the New Testament. The Apostle Paul, for instance, never knew the Gospel of Mark. And so historians treat Paul's 13 letters as a source separate from that of the Gospel of Mark. Again, John never knew the Gospel of Matthew. And so their individual Gospels are considered another two independent witnesses to the life of Jesus. To get more complicated, there are even sources within the individual Gospels, which historians treat as earlier, independent traditions pulled together into a larger text. Much as in the same way as Tacitus used earlier sources in his great History of Rome. One of the Gospel writers himself makes reference to these earlier sources in the opening paragraph of Luke's Gospel. We read, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us." A reference to earlier sources. "Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, all of this stuff, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus," probably his patron, "so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." Whatever else this is, it is a claim to be writing as a historian about historical events using earlier historical sources. In all, there are 7 sources treated by New Testament historians as independent witnesses to the life of Jesus. There they are up on the screen. I'm not going to say anything more about them except to just list them. They are Paul, Mark, James, Q, L, M, and the signs source. But the question is, so what? What's the significance of identifying these multiple independent sources within the New Testament? Put simply, whenever historians are trying to build up a picture of some event or person from the past, you know what the first thing they do is? They try and work out how many independent writers from the period speak about him. In other words, how many different sources are there? The greater the number of independent sources, the more confident historians feel about reconstructing the past. This is known as the criterion of multiple attestation. Aren't you glad you woke up and learnt that today? The criterion of multiple attestation basically affirms, up on the screen, that when numerous ancient sources independently offer roughly the same portrait of an event or person from the past, that portrait takes on greater plausibility. It's exactly the same logic you'd apply to some amazing news from friends, isn't it? If you heard some amazing news from one friend, you might think, oh, I'm just not so sure. But if 2 or 3 friends said the same news to you and you knew they hadn't colluded with one another, you're more likely to take them at their word. Every day we use the criterion of multiple attestation. You just don't use such a nerdy term for it. But the important thing for now is this. The criterion of multiple attestation is amply fulfilled by the texts of the New Testament. Numerous independent sources within the New Testament are saying basically the same thing about the incredible events surrounding Jesus. Well, the final set of sources used by historians to study Jesus are what you might call background sources. Background sources. These are writings from the period which don't actually mention Jesus directly, but do shed a great deal of light on the political, cultural, and religious context of Jesus' life. And they actually tell us a lot more than you might imagine. Background sources provide the canvas, if you like, upon which any plausible picture of Jesus has to be painted. Let me simply list 4 of the important ones. There are about 8 that are commonly used, but you don't want to know all of them. Firstly, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I'm sure you've heard of. The Dead Sea Scrolls reveal just how strict some ancient Jews were, and therefore just how radical Jesus' activities must have seemed to some of his contemporary Jews. Secondly, the Mishnah is a collection of the sayings of about 150 Jewish rabbis from the 1st and 2nd centuries. This is great fun because you get to read what Jews in the period of Jesus were teaching, and you can compare it with what Jesus was teaching. Thirdly, the pseudepigrapha is a collection of sermons and novels and letters written by Jewish leaders in the centuries before, during, and after Jesus' life. And they reveal, among other things, what kind of Messiah the Jews in the period were expecting. Let me preempt something I'm going to say in a few weeks. Jesus didn't exactly fit the job description. Fourthly, to these literary sources, we can add the findings of archaeology. Right now, scores of digs are taking place right around the Mediterranean, and some of them are yielding fascinating results for the study of Jesus. And over the next few weeks, I'll give you a couple of pretty clear examples. Taken together, these direct and indirect Christian and non-Christian sources provide a wealth of information about the Jesus of history. And I hope to show in the coming weeks that the picture of Jesus which emerges from these sources is both deeply credible at a historical level and profoundly challenging at a personal level. So let me close with 2 reflections on this material. There's something quite instructive in all of this, I believe, about the distinctive nature of the Christian faith when compared with other world faiths. Unlike the Hindu Upanishads, which focus on the believer's merger with the life force Brahman, or the Buddhist Tripitaka, which emphasizes the negation of self and suffering, or the Islamic Quran, which focuses on a believer's submission to Allah, the Christian New Testament revolves around a series of events said to have occurred between 5 BC and AD 30. Christian faith, in other words, is fundamentally historical. It is fundamentally historical. It's grounded not in a lone spiritual insight or an unquestionable divine dictation, but in a series of public occurrences in datable time. The acknowledged core of Christianity is Jesus Christ, his teachings, healings, death, and resurrection. And all of these, including the healings and resurrection, remain the subject of serious examination by today's scholars. Because Christianity's claims are historically tangible, they are prodded and probed and evaluated in a manner without parallel in the study of the other world religions. I often say to people, it's as if Christianity places its neck on the chopping block of public scrutiny and invites anyone who wishes to come and take a swing. Come take a swing. And swing they do. Because swing they can. Let me close with a final personal challenge. I would love to think that this series over the next 5 weeks or whatever is going to help you explore the Gospels about Jesus for yourself with the same mental discipline you would give to documents from your own field. Whether that be law or retailing or banking, whatever it is. I'm not saying we need to become experts or nerds. I'm not saying Bible reading needs to be difficult. I'm simply saying that we should apply ourselves to the study of the Gospels and to the figure contained in the Gospels with the same attention to detail and seriousness we would give to any other document from our personal or professional life. The Gospels weren't written for kids. This is not Sunday school material only. These are serious documents worthy of your best questions, worthy of your best strike. And I want to invite us all to come afresh, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, to come afresh to the earliest sources, to the business card of Jesus, as it were, and see the real Jesus. Not some assumed Jesus, the real Jesus. As you do that, I'm confident that you, like the kids on the bus with Joe Lewis years ago, will find yourselves in the presence of greatness. Because the figure in these sources is sheer greatness. Thank you. Yes, the one I listed as SQ, signed source. SQ, it means Samaya Quelle, which is German for signed source, right? It's a source scholars recognise from within John's Gospel. So the writer of John, his distinctive character is all over the Gospel, but then there seems to be this quite unified and different source that he has used within his Gospel. The writing style of which is quite different from his own writing style, which is part of the reason scholars can recognise it. It's called the sign source. It focuses on Jesus' miracles, his signs. It is probably an earlier document that was just like a catalogue of the wonderful signs Jesus did. and John has incorporated that into his gospel. Oh yes, if you didn't hear the question is I said that Christianity quite uniquely places its head on the chopping block of history and invites anyone to take a swing. And I also said that that's quite different from other world religions. For the very simple reason that the central claims of Buddhism have nothing to do with history. And therefore, there's nothing to test. There's no documents, you know, to corroborate. There's no event to corroborate. With Hinduism, it's exactly the same. I mean, the Upanishads don't deal with anything historical. It's really just about a believer's merger with Brahman. In the case of Islam, it's pretty much the same. I mean, although Muhammad was obviously a historical figure, Muslims will tell you that in a sense, Muhammad is secondary to their faith. They don't have faith in Muhammad. All right? Their faith is that he was the prophet who gave us the Quran. And the Quran is not a historical document. This is something Muslims will be quite clear about. It is simply a dictated copy of the Mother Quran in heaven. Right? The angel Gabriel dictated this to Muhammad. And so the Quran is not a historical document that you can pull apart and test, you know, whether its account of that event is accurate and whether it can be corroborated. There's nothing like that in it. You need to read the Quran. I'm always telling audiences, particularly Christian audiences, read the Quran, okay? Let's not just sort of make it up as we go along about Islam. We need to understand what our Muslim friends believe, and the best way in is to read the Quran. Did I answer your question? Oh, yeah. So the Quran is essentially about the rules and practices for submitting to Allah. So it's untestable, completely untestable. Whereas Christianity comes along and says everything revolves around this person who lived here, was born here, did this, said this, was beaten up in this way, was crucified in this particular way, was raised to life, was seen by people, right? This is stuff that historians can go, excellent, right, let's go check that out. Let's go see if that strange pool with five colonnades described in the Gospel of John actually existed, because it says it's just outside of the city gates of Jerusalem. Let's go see if we can find it. They dig up Jerusalem, they can't find it. Some guy writes his PhD, you know, saying, ah, the Gospel of John made a mistake, you know, proudly, you know, submits it, passes, and then we dug slightly to the left and we found it. Exactly as John described. Wouldn't you hate to be that scholar? You know, you'd sort of push your book to the back of the library shelf. But Christianity is of that nature. Yeah. Don't hear me bagging out the other religions. I'm just drawing your attention to something that is quite strange in the whole character of Christianity.